Good day. Today is Tuesday, 19th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. Well, today, the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, flies to Beijing to meet with President Xi Jinping, and he, as predicted, is coming with an enormous, very high-powered Russian delegation, which, in contrast to the American delegation that accompanied President Trump to Beijing a couple of days ago, this time is made up largely or mostly of senior government ministers, though, of course, plenty of business people will also be coming. One of the ministers, or one of the senior officials who is accompanying Putin to China, interestingly, is Elvira Nabiullina, the chair of the central bank, and that tells us that there will continue to be ongoing discussions between the Chinese and the Russians about payment systems, about how to coordinate the two payment systems of the two countries in order to circumvent the dollar-based systems, and also and further, undoubtedly, that there will be discussions to discuss the financial architecture that the BRIC states are quietly constructing, again, as an alternative to the dollar-based system. And the Russians recently have been publishing articles about their feeling that the BRICS Bank, chaired by the former Brazilian president Dilma Rousseff, is unfit for the purpose, the enormous purpose that it has. It needs to be completely reorganized and rebuilt from the top down and massively expanded in terms of its reach. And I'm going to make a guess that this is something that the Russians and the Chinese are going to be discussing with each other in great detail. A couple of weeks ago, back in January, there were protests in Iran, which were connected to the collapse of the Iranian currency. I have expressed puzzlement ever since that the Iranian Central Bank did not turn to the Chinese Central Bank for assistance through the currency crisis in order to stabilize the Iranian currency, and despite the fact that a swap agreement was already in place between the central banks of these two countries, it could be that these Russian comments about the BRICS Bank have to some extent been triggered by those events, with maybe a feeling that the BRICS Bank needs to be expanded into something closer to the International Monetary Fund, a BRICS-type International Monetary Fund, which maybe countries like Iran, who are members of BRICS, might feel more comfortable seeking support from than from the Central Bank of China. All very speculative on my part, and I'm not going to take this discussion, this point further. Anyway, alongside all of that, the Russians and the Chinese are also going to get into detailed discussions about economic, industrial, military, technical, intelligence, foreign policy matters. In particular, they're going to work further and in depth, according to Putin's foreign policy advisor, Yuri Ushakov, about finalising all the remaining details that remain to be finalised in connection with the gigantic Power of Siberia 2 pipeline that the Russians and the Chinese agreed to move forward with last year. I understand that preliminary work on that pipeline has already been underway. By preliminary work, I mean some of the infrastructure. But there no doubt will be many other questions to fine-tune, including the pricing formula, which apparently has been agreed in general terms but may still require tweaking, and all those sort of things. And of course, there will be discussions about foreign policy, intelligence cooperation, military cooperation, all of those things. I mentioned in a recent program that apparently there was a very large Chinese military presence in terms of military observers and officers in Moscow at the time of the 9th May victory parade. And that does suggest that Chinese-Russian military cooperation continues to develop. Well, all of this is underway. And of course, and perhaps unsurprisingly, there are people out there who are intent to do as much as they can to create distrust between the Chinese and the Russians, and to create stories that might lead to the two countries, developing deeper and greater distrust of each other. And this, for the moment, is taking the form in an article which has appeared in the Financial Times. In fact, it is the lead article in the Financial Times. Xi Jinping told Donald Trump that Putin might regret invasion of Ukraine. And we are then told that Xi's comments about Putin's decision to launch his full-scale invasion of Russia's neighbours in 2022 appeared to go further than in the past. And we're told that these comments were made over the course of a meeting with President Trump during President Trump's recent visit to Beijing. And again, according to the Financial Times, and I'm quoting now, according to several people familiar with the US assessment of last week's summit in Beijing, the president, the Chinese president, made the comments during wide-ranging talks that touched on Ukraine and included Trump suggesting that the three leaders should cooperate against the International Criminal Court. So, it's our old friends, the several people familiar with the matter. But note, these are not people who were actually there in the room when Xi Jinping is actually supposed to have seen or said these things, that Putin might regret the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It is rather several people familiar with the US assessment of last week's summit in Beijing. In other words, with whatever post-summit discussion and analysis took place in Washington after Donald Trump returned. Now, I am going to say straight away that this is absolute nonsense. It is inconceivable that Xi Jinping, of all people, would say a thing like that to Donald Trump, the President of the United States, even if Xi Jinping privately thought it. The Chinese leader has been always extremely careful in all discussions with Western leaders to avoid any comment at all about China's relationship with Russia or about his own relationship with the leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin. The Chinese view is that this is a matter between China and Russia, and it is no one else's business. And I have no reason to think that Xi Jinping would, at a meeting with Donald Trump, of all people, decide to go beyond that well-established position of the Chinese leadership and of the Chinese government. And in fact, and most interestingly, the article itself tells us that this is the usual Chinese stance. One person familiar with Xi's meetings with former President Joe Biden said that whilst Biden and Xi had held frank and direct conversations about Russia and Ukraine, Xi had not offered an assessment of Putin and the war. Well, if he was not prepared to do that with Joe Biden, why would Xi Jinping choose to do it with, of all people, Donald Trump? In fact, it's not difficult when you read the article carefully, the Financial Times article carefully, to see what probably actually happened. According to the Financial Times, Donald Trump made a proposal to Xi Jinping that China, Russia, and the United States come together and work together to undermine and ultimately disestablish the International Criminal Court, which of course has issued an indictment and arrest warrant of Donald Trump's friend Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. And it's likely over the course of this discussion that Xi Jinping mentioned that Putin himself might not be entirely hostile to that idea, given that the International Criminal Court has also issued an arrest warrant against him. That's probably what actually happened. And someone in Washington has taken that and spun a story, which has then been leaked to the media based on those words of Xi Jinping, that Xi Jinping thinks that Putin will come to regret his decision to begin the war in Ukraine, presumably because Putin has been issued an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court in connection with steps concerning children that Russia has taken in Ukraine. In other words, it's a spin, a piece of spin, circulated to the media by somebody obviously out to make trouble between the Chinese and Russian leaders, even as they prepare for this summit. And the reality is, of course, that Putin is not going to bring up this story in the Financial Times with Xi Jinping, nor is Xi Jinping going to bring it up with Putin. Perhaps and probably the person or people behind the story understand that. And it may be that another purpose of this story is to insinuate that there are more tensions between the Chinese and the Russians than there really are, given the many agreements that the Russians and the Chinese are likely to agree with each other over the course of this meeting. Incidentally, on the subject of the International Criminal Court, whilst it is undoubtedly true that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Americans all overall have a negative assessment of its activities, I think it is all but inconceivable, given the present state of relations between these three countries, that the Chinese and the Russians would agree to work together with the United States in order to undermine and ultimately disestablish the International Criminal Court. My assessment is that's a non-starter and it is not going to happen. And probably Xi Jinping didn't care very much that Donald Trump brought up the subject, but Xi Jinping probably also said to himself that if this is the sort of thing that Donald Trump is focused on, if the President of the United States is worried and obsessed with a court whose jurisdiction the United States doesn't even recognize, then Trump remains focused on trivialities and irrelevancies and is not really here in Beijing to talk about and move forward with the sort of things that really matter. Anyway, that is my view. Anyway, we will see what comes out of Putin's meeting with Xi Jinping and following Putin's visit to China. What I will say is that I expect this in all respects to be a far more substantive meeting than the one that took place between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. That summit, the Trump-Xi summit, was essentially a hollow affair. It seems even the business people who came with Trump were dissatisfied and unhappy about the fact that they weren't able to make any serious deals with the Chinese or interest the Chinese in any serious deals. Just saying. From the Chinese point of view, its primary importance, other than the fact that it maintains the dialogue with the Americans, was, as I have said in several programs now and in a post on X, to deliver the strongest warning China has yet made to an American president on the topic of Taiwan. Anyway, in this program just now, I have mentioned that the Chinese would be baffled that Donald Trump would be so focused on the actions of a court, the International Criminal Court, whose jurisdiction the United States doesn't recognize. One story which I noticed is receiving zero coverage in the US media, or indeed the Western media altogether, is that a Russian court, the Central Arbitration Court in Moscow, has now delivered its verdict in the case that the Russian Central Bank has brought against Euroclear, the depository in Belgium, where the Russian assets, which have been frozen by the European Union, are mostly held. And entirely unsurprisingly, the Moscow Arbitration Court has ruled that the freezing of the assets is illegal, that Euroclear is acting illegally by refusing to release the assets to the Russians, and it has ordered Euroclear to release the assets and to return them to the Russian Central Bank. Now, Euroclear, entirely unsurprisingly, has said that it will not comply with this order. It says that it does not accept the jurisdiction of the Moscow Arbitration Court. It says that it is, by contrast, obliged to implement the EU's sanctions, which have frozen the Russian assets indefinitely. The Russians, of course, will have anticipated that response from Euroclear. The key thing about the decision of the Moscow Arbitration Court is that it now opens the way for the Russians to bring further proceedings in other jurisdictions against Euroclear. And also, it seems that they might now invoke power available to them as a result of certain commercial treaties they have entered into with Belgium, which allows the setting up of arbitration tribunals not subject to appeal and whose decisions override those of national states or indeed of entities, para state entities like the European Union, whose decisions are binding and, as I said, are not subject to appeal, and which can be set up within the framework of these commercial treaties and which can be established in all sorts of third-party jurisdictions. Many are suggesting Singapore or other places. And well, the Russians can also bring cases, probably based on this decision of the Moscow Arbitration Court, directly relying simply on this order in some jurisdictions as well. Hong Kong is an obvious possibility, just saying. I think that the intricate legal battle between the European Union and the Russians, and between Euroclear and the Russians, has just begun. We could be looking at several years of litigation. And as I've said in many places and already, based on my own understanding of law, I think that the Russians have always had a strong case here. But I also believe that the various debates and arguments that took place in Europe last year over the confiscation of the frozen Russian funds has strengthened that case considerably, maybe even immeasurably. And well, there's also There must also be, or should be, concerns within Euroclear that even if, after a long series of debilitating legal battles, probably taking place in many jurisdictions, even if Euroclear and the European Union ultimately win, it might actually be a dangerous victory in that it would establish a precedent for third parties that if they place their funds on European Union territory and the European Union chooses to freeze them, then these third parties will lose their money and will never see it again, which might act as a massive disincentive for them to place their funds on the territory of the European Union anyway. So, an interesting step, obviously a much anticipated step. This story is only at its beginning. A great deal is now going to happen over the next few years. We will see where it all goes. Anyway, in the meantime, Putin is, as I said, on his way to China. And in the meantime, also, the Russians are once again highlighting the tensions between themselves and the European Union. And here I would just make a few points about this whole topic about negotiations between the Europeans and the Russians. The European Union has been in discussion between itself about beginning talks with the Russians. This was first an idea first floated by Macron about a year ago, but it wasn't taken very far then. It was then revived in December at the time of the discussion about the confiscation of the frozen assets, the Russian frozen assets, again by Macron. Various European leaders, including Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, appeared to support the idea. Merz, the Chancellor of Germany, has blown hot and cold about this. And there have been various discussions with the British, the Scandinavians, and the Baltic states remaining adamantly opposed, as is, of course, the European Foreign Minister, if I dare call her that, Kaya Kallas, who insists that if anybody is going to talk to the Russians, it should be Kaya Kallas herself, but who has also made it absolutely clear that she doesn't think that this is the time to hold talks with the Russians. She says that it would be a mistake to do so, that the Russians are simply trying to lure the Europeans into negotiations, and that, in Kaya Kallas' words, it makes no sense to talk to the Russians in that kind of circumstance, in that kind of context. The Europeans should only talk to the Russians when the Russians are prepared to capitulate and agree to every one of the Europeans' demands on the issue of Ukraine. Demands that, of course, include full withdrawal of the Russians to their 1991 borders, the establishment of war crimes tribunals, the payment of reparations, all that sort of thing. So there has been this debate and argument and discussion in Europe about this topic. And in my last programme, I said that the three names have been floated in Europe as to who might actually be Europe's lead negotiator in those talks. And these are Kaya Kallas, whom the Russians have now said would be basically unacceptable. Peskov, Putin's spokesman, said that it would be extremely unwise for Kaya Kallas to come to Moscow as the lead negotiator on behalf of the European Union. She would not be happy by the results if she did so. A rather strong expression from the Russians. Others who have been proposed are Mario Draghi, the former president, the former prime minister of Italy, technocratic prime minister of Italy, and head of the European Central Bank, and the former chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel. And I said in a recent programme that I thought that Merkel would be an extremely unwise choice. I said that Merkel, as the person who negotiated the Minsk agreement of 2015 with the Russians, and who the Russians strongly feel, based on her own comments, was the person who deceived them, who tricked them through the Minsk agreement, giving Ukraine time to rearm so that Angela Merkel was engaging in duplicity and was not negotiating with the Russians in good faith, that I thought it would be a disastrous idea to appoint Angela Merkel given what the Russians now feel about her, as Europe's lead negotiator. And I noticed that Angela Merkel herself has grasped the point, and she has rejected any idea that she might act as Germany's chief negotiator. She touches to some extent on this back history, though obviously she doesn't admit that she acted in bad faith. She says that in order to be a chief negotiator, a successful chief negotiator, the chief negotiator needs to be backed by power, and as a retired leader, that is something she does not have. That would imply, by the way, that it would have to be the head of government of one of the member states, just saying. And anyway, she doesn't want the job, though she does think that it was a mistake, that it has been a major mistake by the Europeans not to negotiate with the Russians. And she thinks that this policy, this approach ought to be changed. But she has ruled herself out. Now, the Russians have ruled out Kaya Kallas. Angela Merkel has ruled herself out. That appears to leave Mario Draghi, though whilst I think that the Russians would be willing to speak to Mario Draghi, I don't think they trust him, and I don't think they like him, and he is emphatically not the person who I think should be given the job. That's my own personal view. There is still, to my astonishment, a certain belief out there based on comments that Putin made after the victory parade on the 9th of May that Putin would want to see his friend Gerhard Schröder appointed to the post of chief negotiator. This is a complete misreading, in my opinion, of Putin's words and a misunderstanding of his intentions. He has no expectation of Gerhard Schröder being appointed Europe's chief negotiator. He knows perfectly well that that isn't going to happen. What Putin, the message Putin was conveying by mentioning his name, was that he actually doesn't really trust or have very much time for any member of the current European leadership whatsoever. It astonishes me that after 26 years of constant rule in Russia, Western commentators and Western governments still find it so difficult to read and understand Vladimir Putin. It seems to me that the cartoon character that they have invented of Putin has now acquired so much life that they base their interpretations of Putin more on their understanding of that cartoon character, of their own invention, as opposed to the real man. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that. For the record, and just again briefly, returning to the Putin-C meeting that's going to take place in Beijing, this is a meeting of two leaders who completely trust each other, who work together intensively ever since Xi Jinping became China's leader back in 2011, who've obviously developed a very strong personal relationship and who understand each other entirely. And an indication, by the way, of the extent to which this is so, is that Xi Jinping and Putin apparently, at the end of the meeting, intend to hold a joint press conference, as well as issue a final statement, which I remember noticed when Trump came to Beijing and met with Xi Jinping. Didn't happen. Anyway, let's move on now and let's discuss certain other things, and let's discuss firstly the conduct of the war in Ukraine. Now, yesterday I discussed in some detail the reports that have been circulating on the internet about a possible use by the Russians of some extremely powerful, unknown weapon, new weapon, which has apparently been used to attack some target in the Ukrainian city of Dnipro. And there's some speculation that the attack was carried out by a Oreshnik missile. The extraordinary flashes of light in the night sky caught by a video might suggest that. Alternatively, it's been suggested that some entirely different weapon was used, and there's been speculation. There was speculation yesterday and this morning in the media that the weapon in question was an RSD-10 Pioneer, the system that was developed by the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 1970s, which is best known in the West as the SS-20, which was an intermediate forces missile system deployed by the Soviet Union starting in the 1970s in Europe, and which was the system that was used as the reason by NATO to commence their counter-deployments in Western Europe of the Cruise and Pershing II missiles that provoked a significant political crisis in Europe, as I well remember, in the early 1980s. Well, I am still not sure what exactly did take place in Dnipro 2 days ago. But I have now seen a report which says that the attack, and it is now confirmed that there was an attack, was concentrated on the Yuzhmash factory. This is the same factory that the Russians attacked with an Oreshnik missile in November 2024. And Ukrainian reports are saying that during the latest raid on targets on the plant's territory, approximately 8 Iskander-M ballistic missiles, 5 Iskander-K cruise missiles, and 3 guided KH-69 cruise missiles were launched. It was not specified which underground or above ground target was destroyed this time. Now, notice that there is no reference here to a system like the Oreshnik or a system like the RSD-10 Pioneer. But this does appear, from Ukrainian accounts, to have been a simply colossal strike on one admittedly very big industrial facility, the Yuzhmash plant. We are talking about 13 different types of Iskander missiles. In some cases, the Iskander missiles in question launch cruise missiles, 3 at a time, I believe. So There might have been cruise missiles as well. And three guided, stealthy KH-69 cruise missiles as well. This is an enormous concentration of firepower on one location. And I would add that preceding this strike, for the first time, satellite photos have been published. I've seen satellite photos of the Yuzhmash factory, which appear for the first time to give a better sense of the damage done by the Oreshnik strike of November 2024. Now, one needs to be very careful with satellite pictures because they can be manipulated by AI technology. That I have learned from the Financial Times, by the way. And in addition, my vision issues make it very, very difficult for me to study and understand satellite photos anyway. But from what I could tell, the photos which I saw do appear to show a very large area in the central area of the Yuzhmash factory completely destroyed. A large warehouse, most of its roof is gone, and it does appear that there is very significant damage. The photo, the satellite photo, does suggest that the submunitions from the Oreshnik were all targeting this one restricted area. And it does make one wonder exactly what was there. And it was very interesting to see that whilst this particular section of the plant did appear to have suffered tremendous damage, there were other parts of the plant that seemed to be almost completely undamaged. It looked as if the Oreshnik was able to focus remarkably on this one specific building, which must have been the target, and that whatever it was that was being produced in this building was destroyed. Now, according to every report, the Russians, after this long period when they've left the Yuzhmash plant alone, have returned and have conducted a further massive strike on this plant. And I am going to suggest that this is consistent with the Ukrainians trying to put back on track whatever program it was that the Yuzhmash plant was working on in November 2024, and which was comprehensively destroyed in the attack which took place with the Oreshnik then. Now, we have this Ukrainian information that the latest attack was carried out with Iskanders and cruise missiles, not with an Oreshnik and not with some other missile system. Now, I am going to here express my own view about this. I think it is most unlikely myself that the weapon system the Russians would have used against the Yuzhmash factory 2 days ago was an RSD-10 Pioneer, in other words, an SS-20. To the best of my knowledge, every single operational RSD-10 Pioneer in the Soviet Union and Russia was destroyed after the 1987 INF Treaty came into force. One or two systems were preserved in museums, but they are entirely non-operational. Moreover, I doubt that the RSD-10 Pioneer has the kind of precision accuracy that the Oreshnik has demonstrated. It was basically a nuclear system, and it wouldn't have needed that accuracy. And I get to say it, I suspect that that level of accuracy was not technologically achievable anyway in the 1970s. If the Ukrainian account is wrong, and it was not Iskanders, multiple Iskanders that were launched against this facility, then I'm guessing that it was an adaption, a new version of the Oreshnik, which it seems to me is quite possible. The Ukrainians might prefer to downplay the possibility that it was the Oreshnik, which is why we have this story of multiple ballistic missiles and cruise missiles being used instead. It might have been an Oreshnik. The Russians, for their own reasons, might prefer not to mention also that it was an Oreshnik. It might cast doubt on the effectiveness of the strike in November 2024. Just saying. I don't know. It does seem that that video film of the lightning flashes above the Yuzhmash factory is real and not a fake. I just now leave open the possibility that it was indeed an Oreshnik that struck the Yuzhmash factory for a second time, and that it did this 2 days ago. Anyway, this then brings me back to the fact that the Russians are now ramping up their criticism of the Europeans. And we've had very strong statements to this effect by the hard man of the Russian Foreign Ministry. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov. And we have this report from TASS. The Ryabkov highlighted the escalatory narrative from European capitals about the looming threat of a high-intensity war with Russia. As a result of this escalation of tensions, including blatantly provocative moves in the nuclear sphere, strategic risks are increasing, and the danger of a head-on clash between NATO and Russia, with potentially catastrophic consequences, is a real possibility. And then Ryabkov commented on Finland's intention to host nuclear weapons and France and Poland's plans to hold deterrence exercises over the Baltic Sea, simulating nuclear strikes on Russian targets. And Ryabkov said Russia has unequivocally expressed its strong criticism of such preparations by the Europeans. Such steps are being accompanied by hostile anti-Russian rhetoric and are an element of the broader process of Europe's accelerated militarization directly targeting our country. So that was Ryabkov, and it's language that the Russians have repeated in light of certain NATO exercises that are now underway in the Baltic Sea. And the Russian media has also given significant attention to certain, I think, incredibly reckless comments from Lithuania, from the Lithuanian government, about how it's time to plan to penetrate Russia's small fortress, which is to say Kaliningrad, and the moment has supposedly come for NATO to step up preparations to storm Kaliningrad and to dismantle the Russian forces that are stationed there. Now, all of this is indeed unbelievably reckless and astonishingly dangerous. It bears saying that Kaliningrad, the Russian forces in Kaliningrad, are equipped with nuclear weapons. One would assume that that would act as a deterrent. If there were an attack on Kaliningrad, there is absolutely no question that the Russian military would intervene to defend Kaliningrad. It would also undoubtedly take action against the Baltic states themselves, and probably Finland too. The Russians have the forces in the area to do that. In fact, if you tot up the various military forces on each side, the Russians have a convincing superiority overall in the Baltic, despite illusions in the West to the contrary. I say that, though I have no doubt that if we did actually have an all-out conflict in the Baltic, nuclear weapons would very quickly be used. I cannot, for the life of me, understand why European leaders at this extremely fraught and dangerous time, when by every rational calculus should be trying to calm the situation down and lower the rhetoric and the danger, seem to be working incredibly hard to do the opposite. To repeat again a point that I've made now in several programs, it is not even as if the European rearmament drive is going well. The European leadership is starting to understand that all the money it is spending on it is not delivering the goods. And it is not as if the Americans are behind this escalatory cycle. They're actually pulling troops out of Europe and have reversed their plan to deploy more troops in Poland. To goad and provoke Russia, a nuclear superpower, at a time when your own militaries are in a deplorable condition, as virtually every European leader quietly acknowledges, seems to me to be the height of recklessness and foolishness. And it does once again call into question the rationality of decision making in Europe at this time. Anyway, the Russians have again given their warnings. We're likely to see further moves by the Russians as well over the next few weeks in the Baltics. The Russians are now conducting strategic weapons exercises. I ought to say that, in my opinion, these exercises are unconnected with these events in the Baltic. The Russians regularly hold exercises relating to their strategic nuclear deterrent at roughly this time of year, every year. But of course, these exercises, the recent display of the Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile, at its successful launch, ought to underline to European leaders the march of folly that they seem so intent on pursuing. Anyway, that's the situation between Russia and Europe at the present time. Putting aside all of these military moves and counter moves, which, by the way, I believe will ultimately lead nowhere and to nothing, putting aside Europe's inability to agree on a chief negotiator or work out a coherent negotiating policy with the Russians or agree that policy amongst each other. Putting all of these things aside, the war in Ukraine itself goes on, and we've now had further news about what may be, probably is, the developments in the most critical battle on the front lines, which is the Battle of Konstantinivka, which, as I pointed out in many videos, is almost certainly the most important and biggest battle that has been taking place in Ukraine since the fall of Pokrovsk. I'm going to here, by the way, express my own view that Konstantinivka has actually been, in terms of the numbers of forces committed to it, a bigger battle than Pokrovsk. Konstantinivka is larger, and it's not just the southernmost town in the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhivka, Konstantinivka conurbation, at least the largest town on the south. Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, to be clear, are bigger. But it's not only the biggest town at the southern end of this conurbation, but it is also the town that most closely interconnects with the big fortified positions the Ukrainians had established in Donbass after the 2014 war, in places like Bakhmut, Avdiivka, Siversk, all of those places, which have now fallen to the Russians. In a sense, the fall of Konstantinivka would be the fall of the last section of this fortified line. All that would be left would be, if you like, the inner fortress of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, once Konstantinivka falls. And of course, if Konstantinivka falls, with Pokrovsk having already fallen, the Russians would be well positioned to complete an encirclement of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk by advancing behind these towns from the southwest. Anyway, reports that started to appear yesterday suggest that we now are definitely seeing in Konstantinivka an operational crisis. I said that there were reports now that spoke of the Ukrainian troops in southern Konstantinivka having been surrounded. Yesterday and this morning, reports, admittedly all of them on the Russian side of the internet, actually used the word cauldron to describe what has happened. That in southern Konstantinivka, a large Ukrainian force has been trapped, and that once this cauldron is extinguished, that will mean that the whole of southwestern Konstantinovka, west of the river which bisects the town, will have passed completely under Russian control. And this is the section of Konstantinovka that contains the high-rise buildings and the industrial plants. Konstantinovka to the east is apparently more likely lightly built up and is therefore inherently less defendable. So anyway, lots of reports yesterday about the entrapment of Ukrainian troops in this area. I have been saying for some time now that it did seem to me as if an encirclement of the Ukrainian forces in Konstantinovka is developing. Interestingly, the only media outlet on the Russian side that I have confidence in and which threw in a word of caution about these reports about the entrapment of the Ukrainians in southern Konstantinovka is Radovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, which is a strong supporter of the special military operation. Anyway, Radovka said that there's still some uncertainty as to the exact situation, because the Russian military are maintaining tight control over military information. They say that they don't therefore have themselves precise confirmation that this entrapment has taken place. They're waiting for confirmation from their sources on the ground. Reading their article, one gets the sense that they think that this is what has happened, but they haven't yet fully received confirmation of it. Either way, if it hasn't happened yet, they appear to expect it to happen very soon. Now, that is an operational crisis for the Ukrainians in Konstantinovka, but there is further news as well, which suggests that the crisis is actually much greater than that. Because the Ukrainians, ever since the fall of Chasiv Yar last year, have maintained a sizable force in a series of ravines and villages between Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar. The Russian war reporter Marat Khairulin, in my opinion, the best war reporter on any side in the war, and that is a high compliment, because as I've said many times, the quality of war reporting on each side, both Russian and Ukrainian, has been outstanding. Anyway, Marat Khairulin has published photos of this, of the landscape east of Konstantinovka, and it does indeed look broken and difficult in many places. Anyway, the Ukrainians established a significant force there and have made apparently various attempts using this force to conduct attacks on Chasiv Yar. And there's even suggestions that they've had plans to break into and recapture parts of Chasiv Yar in order to complicate the Russian advance in Konstantinovka, though we're told that all of these attacks have been unsuccessful. Anyway, according to the same reports that speak of an entrapment of the Ukrainian troops in Konstantinovka itself, the Ukrainian forces east of Konstantinovka and west of Chasiv Yar in this area of broken country have become trapped as well. And this time, Radovka says that it has information that this is indeed the case. So two cauldrons established in the Konstantinovka area, one in the south of Konstantinovka itself, one east of Konstantinovka and west of Chasov Yar. No Russian source says how many Ukrainian troops are trapped in either position. And my sense is that the Ukrainians have withdrawn most of their troops from southern Konstantinovka, so that the forces that are still there probably number more in the hundreds than the thousands, but that the force trapped east of Konstantinovka is substantial, probably numbering in the thousands rather than the hundreds. Konstantinovka has been a complex and very difficult battle. The Ukrainians have again invested very heavily in defending it. And for once, I can see why. Because the loss of Konstantinovka at this stage in the war is going to make inevitable the fall of the rest of Donbass. If Konstantinovka is lost, then it is difficult to see how the Ukrainians can retain for any very great length of time their forces in the next town to the north, which is Druzhivka. And with a developing crisis for the Ukrainians in the north, near Slavyansk, with Liman also likely to fall very soon, and Sviatogorsk as well. If Konstantinovka falls, we have the biggest cauldron in the war up to now begin to develop, with a simultaneous siege of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and with the access routes to the north and west to these towns likely to be cut by the Russians fairly soon. So anyway, that is the military developments, the major military developments. You will find no mention of any of this in the Western media, where they still cling to the line that the Ukrainians are doing well in the war and are not just holding their positions, but are expanding the territory they control. I've already said that that is nonsense, but anyway, that claim is out there. I've also said that that narrative is largely based on the British, assessments by the British, backed by the Ukrainians and by the Baltic states, no doubt. And I've also said, and said in my program yesterday, that it seems clear to me now that the major reason that this narrative of Ukrainian success is being promoted now is so as to stop whatever confused and muddled moves there might be, to open the way to some kind of talks with the Russians. Given that even those who agree amongst the Europeans to talk to the Russians can't agree what they should actually talk about, and given that the Russians themselves seem to be very little interested in talks with the Europeans, I do wonder a little why the British and the Baltic states and all of them bother so much about this. But there it is. No doubt they have their own arguments and quarrels, and there's all these intense debates in Europe which are taking place. And of course, I know only the tip of the iceberg of what is happening, and I'm content to leave it for them to argue it through. But regardless, the facts on the ground tell us a completely different story. There's been more Russian advances towards Orekhov in Zaporozhye. There's been significant Russian advances east of Slavyansk. Those are to be discussed further on a different day. The big operational crisis is Konstantinovka, and the developments there, well, they tell us ultimately who is actually winning the war. I will just finish this sum up of the military aspects of this war by touching briefly on the fact that the Russians also carried out their own big drone and missile strike against Ukraine. They hammered all sorts of places across Ukraine overnight. The Ukrainians tried to carry out another drone attack on Russia. This time, it seems that Ukrainian drones were not successful in getting through. Whether there's been some adjustments to the Russian defense system after the Moscow attack, or whether the Moscow attack by the Ukrainians used up all the best resources, I'm not going to inquire. But the most interesting thing about the Russian drone attack and missile attack is that, again, Odessa in particular was hammered. And there are reports that the Russians launched further attacks against three ships, commercial ships, heading towards the Ukrainian port of Odessa. The Russians have established an effective blockade of Odessa for some time. I suspect that this blockade is gradually going to tighten. It's something else, by the way, that I noticed is never talked about in the West. Meantime, the other conflict, the one in the Middle East, the one between Israel and the United States and Iran, continues. Now, yesterday, I said that President Trump seemed back at his old game of threatening an overwhelming attack on Iran. I said many times that this seems to me bizarre to the point of being totally irrational. The United States for 40 days launched endless missile strikes against Iran. It expended half its arsenal, apparently, doing so. It failed to achieve a knockout blow against Iran. The government there is still in firm control. The Strait of Hormuz remains under tight Iranian control. The Iranians, apparently, according to the New York Times, have preserved most of their own arsenal of missiles and launchers, 70% of it to be precise. The Iranians still have vast numbers of Shahed drones and are apparently producing many more. The Iranians continue to receive economic aid from Russia and probably from China too. The Iranians continue almost certainly to receive military assistance, mostly from the Russians. Assuming that what failed during the 40 days war would now succeed if it were attempted by the United States again, seems to me, looks to me, the perfect example of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So anyway, I thought it would be a terrible idea. People in the oil markets, the energy markets, thought the same. The price of oil rose. There was a gathering sense of alarm and crisis. And Well, unsurprisingly, and as has happened so often, President Trump then published another statement late yesterday saying that after receiving pleas from the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and the Qataris, he has decided to call off the attacks on Iran that he was intending to do. The Kuwaitis, and the Qataris have assured him that negotiations to achieve a proper peace deal are underway and will soon come. And for that reason, out of his benevolence spirit, of course, that's not what he said, but it was essentially consistent with the tone of what he said. Out of the malevolence of his spirit, he's decided to stay his hand. And though he could easily destroy the Iranians by launching this attack, he has decided that he isn't going to do so. The reality is that the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Kuwaitis definitely do not want an attack by the United States. They made that very clear. They've lost any belief that the United States can win this war. And they worry, as the Saudis have all but said, that if there was such an attack on Iran, Iran would retaliate by attacking their own facilities, including their desalination plants, which for all of these countries would be an existential matter. However, I strongly suspect that the US military have advised the president again that an attack on Iran would be an extremely bad idea, that with the arsenals so badly depleted, there would be no guarantee of a successful outcome. And in the event of failure, which would be likely, the United States overall would find itself in a worse and weaker condition. So, yet again, the attack has been called off. There is, of course, much speculation that this whole circus is basically about President Trump manipulating the energy markets on behalf of his friends and members of his family. What President Trump himself thinks or doesn't think about this is not known to me. All I would say is that certainly some people who do appear to have quite a lot of information have indeed been making a lot of money out of this. But I'm not going to explore this question further in this program. The point is that the attack has again been called off, but the standoff between Iran and the United States continues. The Strait of Hormuz remains closed. Now, there is an article in the Financial Times which speaks of the Saudis and of certain of the other states, Persian Gulf states, Arab Persian Gulf states, now seriously thinking, giving serious thought to the possibility that they might agree a new security architecture for Europe, for the Persian Gulf. And I've discussed this in various programs, as has Larry Johnson on his indispensable Substack site, Sonar 21. And well, we now have the first serious confirmation that this might be happening, that the Saudis and other Persian Gulf states, not the Emiratis, incidentally, the president of the UAE on that issue had a recent conversation with Vladimir Putin, which I suspect was Putin's attempt to persuade the Emiratis to change their stance. But for the moment, there's no sign that they have. Anyway, this is the first article, the Financial Times article, is the first article in the mainstream Western media that confirms that ideas for a agreement between the Persian Gulf states, including Iran, bypassing the Americans to end the war, that idea is indeed being mooted and is being discussed. And the title of the article is Saudi Arabia Floats Middle Eastern Non-Aggression Pact with Iran. And we read that Saudi Arabia has discussed the idea of a non-aggression pact between Middle East states and Iran as part of talks with allies on how to manage regional tensions once the US-Israeli war with the Islamic Republic ends, diplomats said. Riyadh is eyeing as a potential model the 1970s Helsinki process that eased tensions in Europe during the Cold War, said two Western diplomats, as the region anticipates a post-war Iran that is weakened but still poses a threat to its neighbours. They added that the non-aggression pact was among various ideas being considered. Now, this is a truly interesting, but in some ways, very bizarre article. The Financial Times is the closest approximation we still have in Britain to a newspaper of record. I think it took over in that regard from the Times back in the 1980s, the London Times, back in the 1980s. And for a time, it fulfilled the role of a newspaper of record very well. But as it has become more aggressively ideological, to say that that has slipped would be a titanic understatement. Briefly, this article is interesting and it is important because it shows that discussions for a new security architecture in the Persian Gulf involving some of the leading Arab states, including the Saudis and, by the way, also the Iranians, that these discussions are indeed underway, and that is important, but it gives a completely misleading idea of what is going on. For example, it says that this is in part because a weakened Iran after the war would still pose a threat to its neighbours. Iran has not been weakened as a result of the war. It has been strengthened as a result of the war. It has demonstrated its ability to withstand a joint Israeli-American bombing campaign and to survive the killing of its leaders. It has shown its ability to strike back across the Middle East. It's shown its ability to preserve control of its arsenal. And it has demonstrated its ability to close the Strait of Hormuz. It is impossible to see how, in military strategic terms, Iran has been weakened as a result of what has happened since the 28th of February. The reason the Saudis and others are now considering a new security structure for the Persian Gulf is because Iran is stronger, not because it is weaker. Given the way they feel about Iran, if Iran were weaker, they would not be interested in such a security structure. But the bigger, more extraordinary omission in this article is that nowhere in it is there the slightest admission that this proposal for a new security architecture in the Persian Gulf originates with a Russian-Chinese proposal. In fact, it was the Russians who first floated it in the late 2010s. The Chinese have now picked it up and are running with it hard. The Pakistani mediators have apparently proposed it, and of course the Russians are still backing it. This article in the Financial Times implies, in fact says, that this idea for a new security structure in the Persian Gulf is a Saudi idea. It is not originally a Saudi idea. The Saudis may have embraced it, they may have developed it, they may have come up with various ideas about how to fine-tune it, but to omit the role of the Russians and the Chinese is extraordinary, and it tells us a great deal about how the media reports things in the world today. Now, whether we will indeed have a new security structure develop in the Persian Gulf, it seems to me, is still questionable. The Saudis remain very tightly integrated with the United States. Their currency is pegged to the dollar. It will be very difficult for Saudi Arabia to remain Saudi Arabia, in my opinion, and to remove that peg. So the Americans still have considerable influence and considerable tools for influence over the Saudis, which they could still apply. Still, it is interesting that the Saudis are now at least considering this possibility. And that is an important story. And it is a reflection of the failure up to now of the American and Israeli campaign against Iran. It does no one any benefit, however, to give such a distorted account of what is going on. We've now had two articles appear in the Financial Times, one after the other, one about Xi Jinping telling Trump about how Putin might live to regret his invasion of Ukraine, and the other, this article about Saudi Arabia coming up with this plan for a new security architecture in the Persian Gulf, which, frankly, are wrong. Egregiously, badly wrong, and which, I'm going to be polite, show elements of distortion. If the Financial Times isn't careful, it won't just lose its reputation as a paper of record, which, to be frank, I'm not sure it even still has. It will damage its reputation even further in ways which I'm sure many of you can imagine. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.